Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association.
Nope, the guy got it wrong again. It's Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman this week here on Today's Issues. I am joined by my co-host, the stirring, the ever-impressive doctor of... I should have come up with something really good here. Doctor of something awesome. Ray Pritchard.
I'll just take that, a general something awesome. How you doing, Ed?
Hey, I should have thought this all the way through before I, you know, that's a verbal guy. That's where you get yourself in trouble. You start talking and then you've got nowhere to go. I've had that happen before. My wife would just usually look at me with a blank expression. What are you going to say now? How are you going to finish that sentence, husband?
That's right.
I've got myself in trouble. Ray Pritchard of Keep Believing Ministries, keepbelieving.com. Ray, we missed you last week. Where were you?
This summer, I do a lot of Bible conference ministry. And so 2 weeks ago, I was in New Hampshire speaking. And then last week, I was in northern Maine at a Bible camp on the border between Maine and New Brunswick. And just,
goodness.
Oh, man, gorgeous, gorgeous.
You know, I grew up in New Hampshire. I mean, yeah. I'd say this now summer in New Hampshire can be warm. People think, it must be just perfect weather. It can be really muggy up there, but Maine is very pretty in the summer.
Well, I think for people, listeners who've never been to Maine, take a trip, take a vacation to Maine, go to the coast and then go up into the northern part of Maine. I think one of the maybe the most beautiful state in the union. You always hesitate to say because there's a lot of candidates, but it's got to be up there near the top. Just a gorgeous, and so much of it is basically unspoiled.
Yes.
Once you get away from the coast, there are not very many people.
In fact, I was gonna follow it up and say, absolutely stay on the coast. You get inland, and like you said, a lot of trees, a lot of black flies, a lot of mosquitoes during the summer.
A lot of moose,
black bear.
That's right. In certain parts of Maine, you'll see more moose than you'll see people. So it's gorgeous area.
Yeah,
unspoiled, and you're there, and you think this is the way it looked 200 years ago.
So how do you get a gig like that, man? How do you get invited to Maine in the summer? I mean, they obviously don't invite you in the winter.
Years ago, there was a fellow from this camp called Living Waters in Danforth, Maine, which is right on the border. He heard me speak at Word of Life in upstate New York, and I think he went back and said, hey, you ought to invite this guy and see if he would come. And they did, and we loved it. And so last week was probably the fifth or sixth time that we've been to upstate Maine to speak, and love it every time. Fantastic.
Well, now listen, next year, if you need someone to carry your briefcase or something like that, I am available, brother.
All right, listen, we're going to talk this thing out because, you know, we always we believe in the team approach to ministry, right? Never go by yourself, right?
Right. Now, if you're talking about Maine in the summer, I believe in the team approach.
That's right.
If you're going to Maine in the winter, you are on your own.
You're on your own.
Listen, my wife just texted me and she said, I'm with this fella, Pritchard. She loves Maine. She loves Maine. We went there went there to pick up our son who had, we're way off track here, but my son had been there for a summer on a missions trip, and we had a surprise birthday party for my dad for his 80th in Massachusetts, and so we spent a day or so in Maine. My wife just fell in love with it, so she said, I'm with this feller, Pritchard.
Well, and let me just say, to anybody still skeptical, let me just give you two words, fresh lobster.
Fresh lobster. Right. We're going to have to move off this because I'm going to start talking about steamed clams and fried clams. And
it's right there.
All right.
Everywhere you go.
All right, folks, we have a great lineup today. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Ken Costa. You want to know what your calling is in life, how to find out? Ken's going to tell you. Bottom of the hour, Matt Barber has a book out, Hating Jesus, The American Left's War on Christianity. We'll also be talking to Matthew Sorens, who is U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. What do we do with refugees? What is the Christian response? Is there a difference between what the church should do, what public policy should do? And then next hour, New York Times bestselling author Jim Garlow, senior pastor at Skyline Church in San Diego. You've probably heard his one-minute commentary, The Garlow Perspective on AFR. He's written a book, Well-Versed Biblical Answers to Today's Tough Issues. So, man, we have got some great stuff to talk about and to cover. Before we get to our first guest, Ray, did you get a chance to watch any of the speeches, any of the things going on at the...
Pretty much glued to the TV last night.
Yeah.
And, you know, I discovered if you watch CNN or Fox News, they come in and out. We ended up watching C-SPAN a lot of the night because you just get the unfiltered stuff right from the podium.
Oh, all right.
You know?
Yeah, so, I was watching Fox, and for the most part, in some of the speeches, they would let them go. But then they, you know, periodically they would cut in and talk to the panel. So I'll have to check out the C-SPAN approach. Now, one of the things being talked about this morning, I'm not sure it's a real big deal, but accusations against Melania Trump, who apparently plagiarized some of Michelle Obama's speech from 2008, which she apparently, Michelle Obama, copied from Saul Alinsky. So,
brother.
Yeah, I think a speechwriter is probably going to be fired over this.
Right.
Have you been reading up on any of those kinds of follow-up?
Well,
I've
been reading
night?
About it all morning. I mean, it's sort of interesting, isn't it? There was one response, which was very largely positive last night to her speech. She did. I mean, she has not made many speeches or many public appearances, and it was very interesting to listen to her and that, I guess, Slovenian Eastern European accent and her life story and talking about Donald Trump. That was interesting. Then you wake up in the morning and you discover, uh-oh.
Well, I thought she did very well.
I didn't think the speech was
very memorable. So I was thinking when I was reading this morning about this, I thought, what kind of speechwriter pilfers boilerplate? I mean, it was really kind of weak words.
That's right.
You know, and
that's
I thought, why? At least steal from Shakespeare or something.
That's right.
If you're gonna, you know, from Dwight D. Eisenhower on the verge of the D-Day invasion,
right? At least 84 and and 7 years ago, something that's really important. Not because it truly was boilerplate. Right?
Yes, but she did very well for someone who's not political speaker, and I think had some good things, obviously, to say about her husband. Well, who else, what else impressed you about last night?
The single most impressive or most moving moment to me was when Pat Smith, the mother of Sean Smith, who was killed in the Benghazi attack.
Right.
And that's controversial, I understand. But what she said, you couldn't deny her the right to express her emotions. She laid it right at the feet of Hillary Clinton. I know that's a judgment. That's one thing that this whole election is about. But she made the case very powerfully. I thought she was a very, very powerful exponent of what she had to say. And also the sheriff, David Clark.
Yes.
Wow, what a man.
I saw him earlier.
Put him on the ticket.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. No, I think it was during the day someone had sent me a link to an interview he had done with someone. I think it was Don Lemon from CNN.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
I watched that, and I was the same way. I was thinking, man, if this guy pulled me over, I'd hand him my driver's license with shake trembling.
I mean,
like you said, he is a man's man. He calls it like he sees it, has absolute disdain for Black Lives Matter. Now, I will say this about Black Lives Matter. I don't want to get into a whole thing.
Right.
I think that there is obvious perception on the part of the Black community that they're pulled over for driving while Black, and so there's something there that the police need to, and most places need to try to get right. So I'm not saying there's no complaints there being advocated, no legitimate complaints by Black Lives Matter. I, however, am suspicious of the movement because my understanding is, I think it's funded by George Soros, and I just think that means there are radical elements using it. You know, not really really caring for Black Lives, but using it to accomplish its agenda. But David Clark, who's the Milwaukee County Sheriff, he's inspiring. I don't know how he could be used in a Trump administration, but he needs to be given a bump up there and taken from Milwaukee County Sheriff and put in charge of something.
That's right. And let send him around the country and let him speak. You almost go, if you're sort of unsure about Donald Trump, you go, well, it's pretty impressive that a man like that is in his corner,
right?
Because he's not going to be easily fooled or conned or anything else.
Right.
And you get the sense he's not saying anything except what he actually believes. Apparently a man without guile. And
yes. We
need that today. So he was terrific last night. Well, anybody else impress you especially last night?
Well, I liked Rudy Giuliani's speech. I thought it was a little bit overheated, of his, I don't know how to put this.
Delivery.
Cheerleading kind of
right.
thing. But what I did like was his line, which is very memorable to me, about when you call the police to come and save you, they don't ask if you're black or you're white. They just come to save you.
That's right.
And I thought that was a wonderful tribute to the men and women who serve in that thin blue line. Of course, that was part of the theme last night, Make America Safe Again. And we're going to hear more about that, about, being in the corner of the police and battling ISIS and questions about immigration. That is all going forward going to be important, an important element of the Trump campaign. So I did like that speech as well, but loved David Clark. I'm with you on that, so. Well, listen, folks, we're going to move on to our first guest, Ken Costa, who is a professor of commerce, a filmmaker, an author. Actually, he has so much in his bio, I couldn't even fit it in. He's been in banking and investment. This guy has a bio as long as your arm. And he is an author, and he has written a book that I thought would be great for our listeners. The subject matter, Know Your Why. Finding and fulfilling your calling in life. Ken, welcome to Today's Issues.
Thank you very much, and it's very good to be with you. The sun is shining in London for the first time this summer.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm 57 years old, Ken. Is it too late for me to find my calling in life? I mean, is this just a book for young people just getting out of high school, or what?
You're just starting. It's one of the exciting things is that all of us are going to go through different stages of our lives, different phases, different seasons. We're going to live longer, by and large. We're going to do many different jobs. We're going to do different calling, time out, and then more actively. And the question always is, I want to know my why. I want to know that God has called me to a particular place in a particular season of life. And I think that's very exciting. So start at 37. I'm very encouraged to hear you wanting to.
Well, Ken, one of the questions people have is, Christians who know the Lord, love the Lord, read His Word, but they go to work and it's a grind. It's a job. They got to do it. In the midst of the grind of life, how do you even begin to find your calling and your purpose?
Well, the first thing you've got to ask yourself is, why do I do it? So many people do it only for the cash. Some do it, and I understand that. Some do it for the career. I really want to get on. I want to get that promotion. I want to be a director. Some do it because it's a great cause. I work for a great cause, building homes for the homeless or whatever it is. But in all those three, inevitably, you just run out of steam. You run out of energy. You need calling. You need to sort of say to yourself, I understand that there is a calling. And that God has a calling on my life. That's the first step. That's the why. Why am I here? What am I doing? Before one can step into the next question, which is, well, how do I know what it is?
Well, I want to kind of pick up on that idea of the daily grind. One of the things that seems to be kind of being talked about within the evangelical community, I guess, I first started hearing it being discussed after David Platt wrote the book Radical, and it's a fantastic book. I don't mean no criticism of that, but Christians started talking about, well, I need to do something radical, need to be world-changing. So what would you say, Ken, to somebody who's who is a stay-at-home mom or somebody who works in a job where essentially it is a daily grind. They're just simply providing, sure, you know, food for their family. I mean, that doesn't seem very radical, but people are called to be, well, as the Bible says, to work with their hands and to be quiet and tranquil, live tranquil lives. Is that a part of the Christian walk?
Sure, it certainly is. And for the majority of people, that's what life is, wherever you look at it in the globe. This is what's helped me in that process. I wrote a book called God at Work, which is also just being published in the U.S. for the first time. And in it, it's a practical guide on the day-to-day working life. I'm still working at it. I still go to the grind every single day. Two things. One, remember, and it sounds cliched, but it is a truth. My workstation is my worship station. Mm. But it's not just some random idea that I happen to be in a job or I happen to be working or trying to do a startup, but that I do believe that God is there. That's the first. The second is that if the core is right, if you really have your basic core muscle right, as my trainer would tell it to me, if the core is right, the chores are easy to manage. If the core is not right, then the chores become impossible. It's just a grind. You just can't get through the day. So how do we address the core? First thing is to just remember, I am loved, I am known, and I'm called by God. Those three bricks are essential to understanding how to just get on day to day. And then it's an attitude. It's an attitude change. Yes, this isn't the greatest and most stimulating job in the world, but it happens to be where I believe God wants me to be at this stage. So I take control of my life, and I actually do what I do with a good attitude. It will really transform the way you work.
We're talking with Ken Costa, C-O-S-T-A, his last name. He's the author of Know Your Why, Finding and Fulfilling Your Calling in Life. You know, to circle back around to that, the first question is, does the calling, is it one single thing? I guess I'm asking, does it change over time? Will your understanding of your calling be different in your 50s than it was in your 30s or your 20s?
Yeah, great question. Because the short answer is, yes, it does. And that's the exciting bit. See, I think many people have totally misunderstood, believe that, you know, God makes one move on your life, and you either get it or you don't. You're either on the rail or you're off the rail. I don't believe that he does that at all. There's one great calling for every Christian in every age of every kind, of every culture, and that is, of course, to love the Lord your God, to love him with all your heart, your mind, and your strength, and to tell others the good news. But there is also a specific calling, which is that God has us in mind. He loves us. He's a father. He guides us. We have a relationship with him. And there are seasons. Those seasons change. In my 20s, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. Gave all my time to reading and studying law. I eventually ended up being in investment banking for nearly 40 years. And I believe that God showed me through the transitions. How that comes about. The key thing is to be actually settled and content where you are and then discern when it's time to change and then to be ready to face a new season. And we'll face many new seasons in life, and every one of them has the backing of God behind the people who love, known, and trusted by him.
Well, Ken, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in life is to wait on God.
You
cover this. You have an entire chapter where you say we're called to wait. How do you if you catch a glimpse of your calling and you look and you see it, it's like across the river. I don't want to mix, you know, metaphors and you know, yeah, misrepresent the Bible, but you're looking across the Jordan. Sure. You know that's where you're supposed to be. And yet God says, wait, how do you do that?
Well, that is the great thing. You see, we think that God is Google. We think God's a search engine. We think you just sort of press a button and you can find the answer. He thinks I want a relationship with this person. Let me illustrate it. When I'm traveling into Heathrow, it's Friday night, I'm flying in, I haven't been at home, I'm feeling depressed, and I can't get this aeroplane, doesn't want to land because it's in a stack, and I'm waiting. But the reason for the wait is that there isn't parking space. The ground transportation isn't working. If it were to land when I wanted it to land, there would be a crash. So there is a timing that means there's the right time. There's a wonderful verse in the book of Isaiah where it says, you know, in his time, the Lord will do it swiftly. And the operative words are in his time. So there is a time of waiting, and that waiting is as essential a part of our calling as the answer, because that's where we establish our trust and our relationship in him. Otherwise, you know, we would just do it and do whatever comes to our mind at any given time. It may not be what he wants us to do.
You know,
waiting time. And yes, it's difficult, but just two things. Don't waste it, and don't wonder why it's there. Let God sort that out.
Ken, let me ask you to say a word about Christ-style living. All Christians want to be like Jesus. We don't know where to begin. So what is Christ-style living?
Well, the first thing to do about that, get the building blocks right. So you've got to say to yourself, I want to have a Christ-style living. Now, that requires some effort. And therefore, you know, what I've done is, in my life over the last 40 years since my faith came alive, I've read the Bible and the Financial Times, which is our financial newspaper, practically every day. And I think one has to start with trying to get to an understanding that Christ shows us in and through his word and in and through the people around us what living kind of looks like. And then wants us to apply it in real time, practical things, in the harsh commercial compromises of each day. Just the grind that we talked about earlier on, or having to live each day. Now, you could look at this and say, well, that's very difficult. It's not difficult. It's impossible. That is where the Spirit of God comes. He lives within us. We take small steps forward, but we need sort of just the regular practice of reminding ourselves each day that, you know, Christ-style living is the best style of living.
Our guest has been Ken Costa. He has written just a fabulous book. Folks, I highly recommend this. Know Your Why. Know Your Why. Finding and fulfilling your calling in life. Ken, where can folks get a hold of this? And do you have a website or anything if someone wants to get in contact with you or invite you to speak at a conference, anything like that? Go ahead and let our listeners know.
We do. You can get it at all good bookshops in the United States or straight onto Amazon. And there is a godatwork.org.uk or the Know Your Why website, both of which will give you all the information that you would need. And when you know your why, help others find that.
Well, Ken, thank you so much. Thank you for this book. Thank you for what you do
in
your ministry.
Much.
And appreciate you being a guest with us here on Today's Issues.
So good to join you. Thank you very much.
Well, Ken Costa, the book Know Your Why, Finding and Fulfilling Your Calling in Life. Ray, you got to love a guy, a brother with a British accent.
With a beautiful British accent. Could listen to Ken talk all day long.
Me too. All right, folks, we're going to take a short break. A couple of minutes, we'll be back with Matt Barber. His book, Hating Jesus, The American Left's War on Christianity. We'll also be talking with Matthew Sorens with World Relief, talking about the refugee crisis, what are Christians called to do, with the rest of the program after that. Again, just a short break. You're listening to Today's Issues here on American Family Radio. We'll be back in a bit.
On the next Today's Issues, we'll continue to inform listeners.
I don't know anybody who's ever been pulled over for driving while gay.
Encourage Christians to make a difference.
Our encouragement to folks is to find some help to, in a Christian way, deal with the temptation. Amen.
And equip you to help restore the moral foundations of our nation.
It's the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Don't miss the next Today's Issues, weekdays at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on AFR or online at AFR.net.
People always ask me, what all do you see in Washington, D.C. when you go on your spiritual heritage tour? Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. I guess the better question is, what don't we see when we go to our nation's capital on our spiritual heritage tour? We're going to be going in September the 14th through the 17th. The Capitol, all the monuments, the Arlington National Cemetery, the National Archives, the Library of Congress, the Supreme Court. We're even going to George Washington's Mount Vernon on Saturday. So it's going to be a great time in our nation's capital. One of the best aspects of this is we get to spend time together with brothers and sisters from across the country. So if you want more information on our tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, or our Williamsburg, Jamestown, Yorktown trip, either one of those or both of those, you can go to spiritualheritagetours.com. SpiritualHeritageTours.com.
Hello, Americans. From the Republican National Convention, I'm Todd Stearns with this commentary next. So I'm watching Melania Trump's speech last night, and it was a home run. She was funny, passionate, delivered a wonderful story about her journey to America. But I have to admit, there were some moments when I thought to myself, now where have I heard that before? Well, it turns out several passages of her speech are very similar to ones in the speech Mrs. Obama once delivered. The mainstream media is accusing Mrs. Trump of plagiarism. That seems to be a mighty big stretch to me. I don't know anyone in their right mind who would lift anything from a Democrat speech, much less one from Mrs. Obama or her husband. Meanwhile, Republicans are still struggling to demonstrate party unity. There was a nasty floor fight yesterday. At one point, the RNC ordered the police to remove reporters on the convention floor. Now, you would expect that kind of thuggish behavior from Democrats, but certainly not from Republicans. That being said, the GOP needs to knock it off, or else Hillary Clinton's going to be putting her hand on the Bible in January. From Cleveland, Ohio, I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
Welcome back. This is Ed Vitagliano with Ray Pritchard of Keep Believing Ministries. Here in just a moment, we're going to have Matt Barber on. Later this half hour, Matthew Sorens of World Relief talking about the global refugee crisis. Next hour, Jim Garlow, senior pastor at Skyline Church, will be talking to him about biblical answers to today's tough questions. Ray, let our listeners know a little bit about your website, what they can find there, and how they can, if they want to invite you, you know, like to Hawaii or someplace else challenging.
Oh, I'm wide open. I'm wide open. I'll clear my calendar for Hawaii. Hey, somebody's got to do it.
People in Hawaii need to hear the gospel.
That's right. Somebody's got to step up and take one for the team. Anyway, folks, you can come to Keep Believing. That's all one word, keepbelieving.com. If you say .org, you'll come to the same place, keepbelieving.com. We have a huge website of free biblical resources, sermons, Bible studies, outlines, videos, podcasts, FAQs, books, ebooks, and basically we're part of the Ordnance Depot of the Body of Christ. We take the gospel ammo, we take the biblical ammo, and we pass it up to the frontline soldiers. So if you're a teacher, a Bible student, a pastor, and you know, these days, Ed, we have more people coming to us from around the world than anywhere else, because there's, you know, it's not the same way in Pakistan or India or say China as it is here in the U.S. in terms of biblical resources. So we're just delighted for folks to come see us. There's a contact form on there. You can send me a message. And when people write me, I write them right back. And my email address is ray@keepbelieving.com. So come see us on the internet.
And Ray didn't ask me to do this, but he really is a fine Bible teacher. So, folks, get over to keepbelieving.com. And maybe if you're having a conference or a Bible week and you want someone who is just solid as can be and also just a wonderful teacher, find out about how to get in touch with Ray Pritchard. Have him come. You will not be sorry. So, anyway, we have our next guest is already queued up since we had a British guest on before the break. I like to use queued up. Matt Barber, who's editor-in-chief of barbwire.com. He's also author of the book, Hating Jesus, The American Left's War on Christianity. We're going to talk to Matt about that in just a few minutes. Matt, welcome to today's issues.
Gentlemen, how are you? I'm sure you're enjoying a beautiful, chilly day in the great state of Mississippi.
Oh, yeah, it's chilly, all right. I just try to survive July and August and just get through into September and October when it turns. Yeah, I love sweater weather, and that's what I live for. So thank you for reminding me how hot it is outside, Matt. Hey, listen, before we got to your book, Hating Jesus, that is not what you do. That is what the secular left does. I want to talk to you about an article that you wrote for WorldNet Daily. The title of it is Islam at War with the Delusional Suicidal West. By the way, folks, it is loaded with some great and applicable statistics. Very, very informative. You can find it at WND.com, WorldNetDaily.com. Great quote, Matt. You were talking about those in the West who seem to be appeasing radical Islam, and you said, I was reminded of a quote by the great Winston Churchill when he said, an appeaser is one who feeds a crocodile hoping it will eat him last.
Yeah, and regrettably, as I point out with one of the opening lines, I'll say it again, political correctness is a barrier to truth and a pathway to tyranny. It's also deadly. And I have a couple quotes here, one from Barack Obama. He says, Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance. Well, evidently, Mr. Obama has not read the Quran and the writings of the prophet Muhammad. I also point out Hillary Clinton says, let's be clear, Islam is not our adversary. Muslims are peaceful and tolerant people and have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. Well, yeah, some Muslims have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism, you know, moderate Muslims. They stand back and silently watch as the Orthodox Muslims, who are true followers of Muhammad, carry out terrorism. And it's just so frightening to sit back and watch the utter delusion that we see as a matter of public policy here in the United States when we have a president and a candidate, presumptive replacement here, if she should be elected, who are completely in denial about the true threat that Islam poses, and they won't even say the word. They won't even acknowledge that there is a threat, much less do something to fight back against the threat.
You know, Matt, we're almost overwhelmed now. I mean, it was a month ago, it was Orlando, the other attacks, and then came Nice, and then almost unnoticed, at least here in America, is the knife attack that took place in Germany by a so-called self-radicalized Muslim teenage boy, supposedly. Yeah. So what can we do? We hear it said, you know, it's only a tiny fraction of Muslims are really radical, and then most are, quote, moderate. What can we in the U.S. do? Because things, they appear to be spiraling much worse now than even a year or so ago.
Well, regrettably, we have, as official public policy now, you know, Hillary Clinton has said that she intends to bring in a million new Muslim refugees within her first term alone. And there's something called immigration jihad or migrant jihad that Islamists are dealing with. We see it happening in Europe now, where they come in as refugees, so-called. And you notice that it seems like 90% of them are young, fighting-age men. It's extremely odd when you look at all of the images and the film of these refugees pouring in. And so this kid on this train in Germany, I tweeted out after this happened in Germany, where he took a hatchet to a number of people on this train and was the 17-year-old Islamic migrant jihadist, this refugee jihadist, hacked at all these individuals until he was shot dead by police. I tweeted out, if Angela Merkel had a son, he would look like this kid. You know, you remember President Obama saying, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon Martin. Well, in this case, you know, Angela Merkel and other PC progressives who are engaging in this multiculturalism are responsible for opening the borders to all of these refugee jihadists. And so, of course, we're going to see these attacks like we see in Nice, this horrific plowing down of, you know, of these innocents on the streets of Nice. And it's only going to get worse. This has been the bloodiest summer I can remember in terms of Islamic jihad.
We're talking with Matt Barber, editor-in-chief of barbedwire.com. Matt, we want to give you a few minutes. We want to talk to you about your book, Hating Jesus, The American Left's War on Christianity. Tell us, obviously the title's pretty self-explanatory, but tell us why the American left is, in your opinion, at war with Christianity. What is the motivation here?
Well, there are multiple motivations, but the primary motivation, as I point out in the book, and people can get it at Amazon.com, by the way.
Okay.
Just put in Hating Jesus, go to Amazon, you can get it there. But the primary motivation here, as I point out, I say, have you noticed, we're talking about the subject of Islam here, have you noticed how progressives will trip over themselves to defend Islam and Islamists? They won't even say radical Islam and so forth, yet it's so counterintuitive that they would do this because they're coming for them too. They intend to kill them too, and you know they execute homosexuals, for instance, as a matter of law in Saudi Arabia and Iran, and of course ISIS, throwing them off of buildings and so forth. That is inherent within the teachings of the Quran with Islam. Well, the reason they hate Jesus is because Jesus is the personification. He is the embodiment of truth. So you say, why do these progressives partner effectively with these Islamists and are so favorable to Muslims? And it's because they have a common enemy. The old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, that common enemy happens to be truth. And these are both pagan ideologies that are in opposition to truth. They are under deception, and truth is the person of Christ.
We're talking with Matt Barber. He's the author of Hating Jesus, The American Left's War on Christianity. And folks, this is a great book, because it just goes down chapter by chapter, this area, this. If you want to know the latest, what's happening, the war on Christianity, get Hating Jesus. Let me just ask you about chapter 13, because I'll just read the title, Forcing Churches to Perform Gay Weddings. But Matt, we were promised, right? We were promised this would never happen. What's changed?
Well, this is the incrementalist approach that the left is so adept at, and unfortunately, conservatives and Christians have all too often tried to appease and negotiate with leftists and give them a little bit here. And here we are saying, oh, well, if you just put in a little religious liberty protection or whatever, you know, then we may sign off on this. It's nonsense. The ultimate goal here is effectively the criminalization of Christianity. We already see it happening in Europe, where churches are being compelled. Pastors will be jailed in many instances if they do not perform so-called same-sex marriages within the walls of the church, thereby desecrating both the institution of marriage and the church. Those are strong words, but let's be clear here. Same-sex marriage, at its core, at its root, is the sin of homosexual behavior, expressly a sin. So pastors who are going to be obedient to God cannot perform these same-sex marriages. Yeah, the main line, some of the liberal churches, PCUSA and everything, they're completely apostate. They've gone off the deep end. They're going to do, you know, they're in defiance of God. They're in rebellion against God, along with the secular left. But it is coming here. Make no mistake about it. We already have in California now, California law, and implementing Obamacare in such a way that says churches have to pay for abortions and offer abortion in insurance coverage. And now we saw out in Iowa, for instance, where they're interpreting their human rights, their sexual orientation stuff, to say that churches cannot even preach against transgenderism or homosexuality. You can't even preach out of the Bible about homosexuality, and you must open your bathrooms up to men in mini skirts and men pretending to be women and so forth. And they're telling churches that they have to do this. They've been sued, in fact, in Iowa, the city of Des Moines, and this human rights tribunal, these kangaroo courts that they have out there. And so it is one tiny step to say affirmatively, either you open your doors, and if you're going to open your doors, if you're going to do weddings in your church, you have to do gay weddings as well. And I guarantee you, folks, it's coming. It's right, I mean, and coming soon to a church near you.
If you want to find out more about the American left's war on Christianity, you're going to have to pick up a copy of Matt Barber's book. It's titled Hating Jesus, the American Left's War on Christianity. Matt Barber, editor-in-chief of barbwire.com. Matt, thank you so much for being our guest today on Today's Issues.
Always a pleasure. God bless, guys.
All right, thank you. Folks, it really is, this country has changed dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. It seems sudden, but it really is the net result of decades of a move away from God. And so, while the collapse appears to be sudden, it is like a building that collapses after decades of decay. So we need to pray for revival in this country, for the hearts, first of all, of America's Christians to be turned back to the Lord in repentance and humility and faith, and then pray that God might have mercy on our nation. All right, we're going to shift gears here and talk to Matthew Sorens, who's U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. That is the humanitarian branch of the National Association of Evangelicals. Matt, along with Stephen Bauman and Issam Smear, I hope I'm getting that right, co-authored the book Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. Matt, welcome to Today's Issues.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Now, you guys, by the way, did I get Issam Smear's name pronounced right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, that was just pure luck, actually. But you guys have picked out a topic that could not be more controversial in our day and time. You know, refugees, that has never been, I don't think, you know, particularly controversial, but because of the fact that radical Islam, you know, clearly seems to be at war with the West, now refugees are controversial. So why the need for the book? Did you see this coming, or was it just kind of a bit of luck that you wrote the book at a time when it was becoming controversial? Tell us how this book came into existence.
Yes. I mean, so World Relief has been working with local churches throughout the U.S. to serve refugees for many years, more than three decades. So it's not a new issue for us, but I think as it became more of a political issue, as you said, even a year ago, you know, other immigration issues were controversial, but refugees were pretty, you know, not particularly controversial. Everyone comes in with legal status. There's people fleeing persecution. So we've never found it to be that controversial. But as it became a big issue in the news, we really wanted to provide a resource for followers of Jesus to say, this is an issue of, you know, there's policy issues here, there's economic issues, there's security issues, but let's make sure that first and foremost we're grounding our thinking in what does the Bible say? Because actually we did a survey with Lifeway Research and found that only 12% of evangelical Christians in the U.S. said that their views on these issues of refugees and other immigration issues are primarily influenced by the Bible, which is actually a little bit disturbing to us. We wanted to make sure that we're providing a grounding in how do we look at what the Bible says, in terms of loving our neighbors, in terms of certainly the government's God-given authority to maintain order and security, and that's part of it as well. But how do we look at all that together?
So, Matthew, let's just jump in on the biblical side for a moment. And obviously, the reason your book is here is because the Bible has a lot to say about it. But chapter 2 has the title that grabs your attention, Jesus Was a Refugee. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by that is in Matthew chapter 2, in what we think of as a Christmas story, we read that after the Magi depart, which is kind of where we tend to end the Christmas story. My 3-year-old daughter noticed last Christmas that our nativity scene, and I don't know about yours, doesn't have a King Herod figurine. I haven't seen one yet that does.
Right.
But that's actually a pretty important part of the story. The Magi leave, and immediately after, Joseph is warned in a dream that King Herod, this tyrannical Middle Eastern king, is coming to basically kill all the little boys in Bethlehem. And Joseph is told to get up in the middle of the night and to take Jesus and Mary and go to Egypt. And they do so. We don't know a lot of details about their experience there, but that was part of our Lord and Savior's life as a human being, was being a refugee in a foreign land. We don't know how they were treated, if they were welcomed, if they were shunned, if people thought Jesus might have some diseases or Joseph might steal some carpenter's job. We don't know. But that was part of Jesus' experience, along with a number of other heroes in the scriptures. So I think that's important, you know, for people who go to worship a refugee every Sunday, that is part of how we think through these issues.
So how would you define what a refugee is? You mentioned the immigration question. That's been a little bit more controversial over a longer period of time, you know, years, whereas the refugees really just became controversial as the war in Syria heated up. So what's the difference between an immigrant and a refugee?
Yeah, that's a great question. So refugees are a subset of immigrants. So just like, you know, Baptists or Presbyterians would be a subset of Christians. Refugees are specifically defined as individuals, and this is under U.S. law, going back to at least the Refugee Act of 1980, as individuals who have fled their country because of persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution, specifically because of their race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. So we had very large numbers of refugees who came in after the war in Vietnam. That's actually when World Relief began resettling refugees in partnership with many local churches, up to 200,000 in 1980, huge numbers, far higher actually than are coming in right now. Last year, 70,000 refugees came into the United States from all countries. But they all have gone through a process with the U.S. government where they have been interviewed many times and their stories checked out to make sure that they meet that legal definition of a refugee. They're not just seeking a better life generically or a better economic situation, as sympathetic as that may be, but they have to actually prove that they have a well-founded fear of persecution for particular reasons.
We're talking with Matthew Sorens. He's one of the co-authors, one of three co-authors of the book Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. Now, your book does a lot of things. It gives us, you talk about the scope of the refugee crisis, which frankly, it's global. It's bigger than we've imagined. You talk about the biblical dimensions, a lot to say there. But I want to make sure you say something about what the church should do. And I know we can talk about the church as a denomination or a federation or, you know, association of evangelicals working together, but there's also the local church, the most discreet expression of the body of Christ, people gathered in one particular location. What can the church do to help with the refugee crisis?
Yeah, I love that question because that's really, for us at World Relief, that is our passion. I mean, our mission statement is literally to empower the local church to serve the most vulnerable. And we do that in various parts of the world in response to this refugee crisis. So we're coming alongside churches in Jordan and in other parts of the Middle East where they have, you know, one tiny little evangelical church serving 1,000 Syrian refugees, some of whom are persecuted believers, many other of whom are Muslims or other religious minorities like the Yazidis. So that's part of what we're doing is responding there. But we also have opportunities for churches here beyond just giving or, you know, praying. They can also welcome the relatively small percentage of refugees who are admitted to the United States. World Relief was responsible last year for a little bit more than 7,000 refugees who, under agreement with the State Department, we met them at the airport, and our goal is for a team from a local church, we call that a good neighbor team, to be matched up to every refugee that arrives. So when they arrive at the airport, that team from a church has already helped to set up their apartment, some basic furnishings, is there to welcome them, and then through the first several months that they're in the country, really to help them integrate. World Relief, our staff can help with some of the technical details of getting a Social Security card and helping find work and getting kids into school. But the biggest need from local churches is really just for friendship. And we see that both as an opportunity to welcome and to stand with the persecuted church, because if you look at who the refugees the U.S. has admitted over the past decade have been, more have actually been Christians of one sort or another than of any other religion. So I think right now people tend to hear refugee and think Muslim. That's actually not accurate. But the flip side of that, there are some Muslims and some Hindus and Buddhists and other people of other faiths coming in, and we actually see that as a really remarkable missional opportunity. We're told to make disciples of all nations, and we can certainly do that by going to the ends of the earth, and we should. But we also should recognize that God is bringing the nations to us. And people from parts of the world that we've been praying for many, many years and decades might be landing in our own communities. But we can't presume that just because they're in the United States, they're necessarily going to interact with a follower of Jesus. And we as Christians can go out of our way to be there at the airport, to welcome them, to love them as our neighbors, and then as we have opportunity to, as First Peter says, to give an answer for the hope that is within us.
Matt, one of the things Christians struggle with, and it's not just on this issue of refugees, but in a lot of areas, is how do you apply the Bible to daily life living in a republic like ours, where we as Christians are part of the society that makes laws. So we vote for this, we vote for that. Since government is also called to be a minister of God, so Romans 13 says, how does a Christian bring the Bible to bear on an issue like this? I'm assuming you believe, probably like everybody else, the government, our government, can't allow every refugee in who may want to come here. So how does a Christian speak Christianly to the government as it tries to decide who and how many?
Yeah, that is a great question. So, I mean, I think the primary role of the church in this is on the ground welcoming people. But there is also a part of loving our neighbor, and that means loving our refugee neighbor, but also our fellow American citizens, that goes to those policy questions. And I think they're incredibly important questions. And I think it's important as believers that we ground our approach to those things, both in the Bible first and foremost, but also in the facts of what's on the, you know, what's the reality. And there are some actual threats that we need to be aware of. I think some of the threats we hear about are overstated, and some of them are not accurate, but there are some real threats, too. So we have an obligation, I think, to expect our government to maintain security. So, for example, last year there were 70,000 refugees brought into the United States. One thing that I think is a real common misconception right now is, well, those people, maybe because of all the images of people floating ashore in Europe, which is a very different circumstance, people don't realize the process that refugees resettled through that resettlement program have to go through. It's a process that usually involves at least 18 months of vetting, often much longer. I interviewed people for Seeking Refuge for this book who had been through 6 different interviews and taken, you know, 3, 4, even more years than that, once they were, you know, allowed to begin being considered for settlement. And that only happened for less than 0.5% of the world's refugees. But actually, you know, I think it's appropriate for us to ask those questions and to hold our government accountable for a secure process. I also think it's important, though, to know that we actually have a really strong record as a country on this. I mean, with more than 3 million refugees resettled in the last, you know, 35 to 40 years, there has never been a terrorist attack committed in the United States by someone who came in through that U.S. refugee resettlement program. And I think a big part of that is that part of it is a very thorough vetting process, a much more thorough vetting process than any other category of immigrant or visitor. And there were 70 million visitors to this country last year. So, you know, it's a very thorough process. But the other part of that is that those refugees were welcomed. They were met at the airport by a nonprofit or faith-based organization, and in many cases by a local church. And that's actually the best antidote to any sort of radicalization that you could imagine, because it's very hard to believe ISIS's lie that all, you know, Christians are your enemies or all Americans are your enemies, when it was a team from a local church that welcomed you at the airport. And that's, again, only a minority of the refugees being resettled are actually from Muslim backgrounds. Many more are from Christian backgrounds. And there it's us standing with the persecuted church.
Our guest has been Matthew Sorens. He spells his last name S-O-E-R-E-N-S, if you want to look him up. The book that he co-wrote with 2 other men, Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. Matthew, thank you so much for being our guest here on today's Issues.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right, folks, we're going to take a 5-minute break for news. When we come back, we'll be talking with Jim Garlow, senior pastor at Skyline Church in San Diego, California, another tough place for Christians to live and work. And we'll be talking about biblical answers to today's tough issues. Ed Vitagliano and Ray Pritchard, your co-hosts today. You're listening to the program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Again, 5-minute break for news. We'll see you in a bit.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.